Your day is off to a great start so far. It's 10:07. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Get set for another edition of Science Files coming up this hour. And joining me this morning, St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker. And I'll make the introduction in just a moment. We've got an open hour for you next hour. We call it Manic Monday, our first open hour of the week. And, of course, as always, anything goes next hour. After the news at noon, we'll chat with ex-NHLer Dennis Marouk. He'll be here later this month for the Heart and Stroke Foundation's Hockey Heroes Weekend. And he recently teamed up with sportscaster Ken Reed on a book called Dennis Marouk, The Unforgettable Story of Hockey's Forgotten 60-Goal Man. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon when Pier 21's Dan Conlon joins me again with a Halifax History Moment. 10:08, but this hour it's time for Science Files, brought to you by Meadow Ridge Estates, bungalow lifestyle living right here in Halifax. And joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
Good morning, good morning.
How are you doing this morning,
sir? I'm doing pretty good. I'm recovering from a little bit of a virus. I was down at Northwest Cove yesterday giving a talk, and I kind of coughed and spluttered my whole way through that one. But it was a lot of fun. That was the Athenaeum Society of Nova Scotia, and a thank you to all the people who invited me, Jim King in particular, the president of the society.
What is the Athenaeum? And how did you pronounce it?
Athenaeum Society. Yeah. So it's a society that's modeled on one that I think comes from the UK of many, many decades ago, a group of people who were interested in learning about various different topics and being essentially a learner society and having people come in and talk. So they've got Graham Steele going down there next month, I believe.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Didn't know they existed.
Yeah.
Well, I should also take this opportunity before we get things going here to congratulate you on your award. You were presented with the KELAC Award recently, an award that recognizes, it says here, outstanding contributions to astronomy communications, public education, and outreach.
Thank you very, very much. Well, and as I have said before, I believe that I would like to say that you are a big part of this, and 95.7 in general have given me a chance to come on and sort of like talk about what I mean. Okay, I'll be completely honest. It's really amazing when you get awards for doing things that you love doing. And so this is one of those situations. So I feel especially lucky to get an award for something that I just love doing anyway. So thank you to 95.7. Thank you to all the listeners who call in with the questions as well, because that's what makes this
so
fun.
We'll get a share of the pot then, right?
Absolutely. I'm totally prepared to give you a share of the pot. In fact, I'll give you all of it if you want, because it's $0.
$0. You got a trophy or something.
I get a certificate. Yeah, I do get a certificate. Yeah.
All right. And this is a prestigious award. I mean, this is...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this the award itself comes from the Canadian Astronomical Society, but I should say the KELAC Award is actually something that is awarded by three astronomical societies in Canada. There is the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, which is kind of like the amateur part, although professionals are a member of it in some cases as well. And then there's the Canadian Astronomical Society, which are the professional astronomers, and then there is something called the FAAQ in Quebec. And so each of those organizations offers the KELAC Award to their own, a member of their own society as well. So I got the one from the professional astronomers, the Canadian Astronomical Society.
Well, good for you. And again, congratulations. The 2018 KELAC Award presented by the Canadian Astronomical Society.
Yep.
And Dr. Rob Thacker, recipient this year. 10:11 is our time, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255 if you've got a comment or a question for us here this morning. There's been a meeting in Switzerland, I believe they got underway last week, Rob Thacker, in regards to the hope that they can come to terms on a global treaty to kill or ban killer robots by 2019. These are referred to as lethal autonomous weapon systems, or LAWs. And while there's none that have been introduced to the battlefield yet, apparently they're progressing with these kind of weaponry.
Yeah, no, I think this is really something that not only is technologically challenging, but it's ethically and morally challenging to us as well. So I really struggle with this. You can argue, if you want to, that, well, if you look at the history of warfare, we've been having various instruments of destruction that are self-guided for a long time. And is it really any different to have autonomous weapons that are going in and basically targeting military installations and, in some cases, humans as well, and in many cases, humans? So I kind of struggle with this. I worry about it. I don't actually worry about it from the perspective of what happens if these things go wrong. I know a lot of people do, but I'm not so concerned about that. I'm more sort of concerned about the fact of the matter is when you kill individuals, when you do it yourself as an individual, you feel the moral responsibility for doing that. Whereas once we have these things that are going off and doing what in some cases are going to be reprehensible acts, and should we be able to do that as a society? I really don't like that. I think to a certain extent that sanitizes war still further. War is already sanitized to a certain extent. I mean, this idea of people sitting in a warm room hundreds of miles away robotically flying things is not appropriate. I mean, I'm a big believer that if you're going to go to war and this is something where people are going to die, then the costs of that have to be understood in a human sense. So I'm quite strongly against autonomous robots being involved. I mean, there are all of the technological issues. We can talk about those for hours. Huge issues there, facial recognition and so on. But I don't want to do that. I think this is a moral and ethical issue. And so as such, war is something that we still haven't figured out a way to avoid. And I don't think that sanitizing it in this particular way is a good way of doing that.
Yeah, more than 80 countries have been meeting in Geneva, Switzerland. I believe they got together last week. And again, their hope is to have a treaty in place by 2019. As you pointed out, their big concern is that these what they call these laws with critical functions of selecting a target and then killing without meaningful human control.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. It is a real concern. And then the question becomes, I mean, we do reparations and so on. I mean, whose responsibility is it then, right? Who's responsible for the individuals that get killed? I mean, this is why I really struggle with this. How can you wash your hands of something that is so devastating? And really, I don't like this. And technology in war in general, I think, to a certain extent. For example, I'll give you a really simple one, like how much easier it becomes to kill someone with a gun versus a knife. Mm. Like if you want to kill someone with a knife, then yeah, that's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to be horrible. Shooting someone with a gun is still equally horrible, but it's still that much easier thing to do.
Yeah, you're more detached.
Right, you are more detached. And this further detaches us away from what is one of the worst things that humanity does. And I don't think that's a good thing. I really don't.
10:15 is our time. Dr. Rob Thacker with me here on a Monday morning. This is Science Files. And if you've got a comment or a question for us this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also send us a question via email. My email address, rick.howe@news957.com, or tweet us a question as well. Our Twitter handle, @TheRickHowe Show. We're back with more with Dr. Rob right after this quick break. Coming up now to 10:18, it's a Monday morning Science Files here until 11 with Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. And Dr. Rob, let's talk about, well, I should mention the numbers again, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255.
I want to get a little dig in here.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. So when I came in and I put the headphones on, they were really massively so whoever was in this seat before me has a really big, big head.
Shall I tell you who it was?
Well, no, you can keep that quiet, but the listeners can probably guess. No.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. One of two counselors. Obviously, that's a bit of a hint here this morning.
Or big hair, one of the two. I'm not sure which.
Trillions upon trillions of viruses apparently are falling from the sky each and every day. What's that Chicken Little story? The sky is falling, the sky is falling. Well, when it comes to viruses, apparently trillions upon trillions each and every day. What's this all about?
I really love this. I think this is super interesting, and it's not something that we think about or talk about very often.
Well,
so
really?
I think this is really, really cool. And so this is a study that's looking at where viruses come from in terms of, are they coming from the water? Are they coming from the atmosphere and so on? And in this particular case, they're looking at viruses literally raining down from the sky. And so this is kind of something that I hadn't really thought about, because when most of the time people talk about, is a virus airborne or not, if you're worried about infection. Yeah. And so people know that viruses that get airborne, they are sort of like really infectious and so on, where a lot of them just carried in liquids and so on. But in this particular case, they're talking about viruses that can be airborne and actually will circulate around the globe, quite incredibly. And a lot of this is generated by viruses that are in water, getting spray lifted up from the oceans and brought up high into the atmosphere and literally sort of like moved around on various air currents as well. And so they're saying like they put buckets in some... on the Sierra Nevadas in Spain, I believe it was. And then they measured the overall amount of viral buildup within these buckets, literally just sort of like coming down. I don't know how they can separate it from being really high up versus sort of like blowing around the mountains themselves. They probably got an argument for that, but I don't quite understand that myself. Anyway, but the whole point of this is suddenly you've got this thing, what they're calling the virosphere.
800 million viruses every day?
Yeah, so I mean, you shouldn't worry too much because we are living in this all the time, obviously. So your body is completely adapted to this. And so that is actually one of the really interesting things about this, that when you look at the evolution of DNA, viruses have contributed to that quite significantly. In fact, some estimates suest that between 40 to 80% of our DNA has been touched in one way or another by some kind of virus injecting DNA or just moving things around or something like that. Now, that takes a bit of time for that to sort of like filter out from one given individual into the overall population. But it does happen over time. And so people say even just sort of slightly under 10% of our genome could have been impacted by viruses over the last million years.
Wow. Because when you think of viruses, you're thinking of things that make you ill and such.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so the other thing that I think is really interesting to talk about is the fact that we often think about viruses in the human context. And so when it comes to avian flu, we hear about that and pig flu as well. Obviously, we're concerned about transferring those to humans. But the thing that's the sort of like biota that's most impacted by viruses is probably bacteria. And we don't really think about that, do we? We don't think about viruses impacting bacteria. But in fact, they've done some really interesting studies on seawater and bacteria in seawater. And they found that if you filter out all of the viruses, then in fact, that can cause real problems because some of the viruses actually attack certain bacteria. I think they call them bacteriophages, actually. And so they will kill off certain bacteria. And you think, well, okay, what's wrong with that? Well, it turns out there are other things in the ecosystem that survive off those dead bacteria.
Yeah.
And so if you take them out, you can actually impact the plankton. Right. So if you take the viruses out and the viruses aren't killing things, then you will actually impact the overall food chain in the ecosystem.
They're important to our very existence there.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. I mean, it's kind of I have a colleague who really hates it when I say this, but I think it's true that everything seems to be connected in the most unusual ways that we don't think about. But viruses really do impact our ecosystem. West Nile virus as well has had a huge effect on bird populations, like sort of like I think it's been killing crows and lifting up raven populations as a result. So these things that we tend to think about from the human perspective, they're absolutely out there in our ecosystem all around us, impacting other biota as well. I mean, I won't go with that story because it's kind of close to the edge. But anyway, so they really are out there and impacting us in ways that we don't think about. Right? We really don't.
Well, no question. Very interesting. And you just don't, you know, it's hard to grasp 800 million viruses like falling down from.
And I mean, it sounds kind of worrying when you talk about it. But like I said, because we are as individuals strongly adapted to the ecosystem that we live in. I mean, one of the things that we're noticing with like our own immune systems is the more we keep things clean, the less effective our immune systems are actually fighting off infection. And so there is this whole issue, especially with people developing allergies to things, that actually early exposure to allergens may actually help build up resistance, right? So that's still a thesis that's being worked on in detail. But this is one of the things, like your immune system builds up literally from exposure to things that are bad for you. right? So this is kind of incredible. And so the overall sort of like survivability of our ecosystem is dependent upon having these threats that we are actually developing immunity to at some level.
Yeah, something along the sidebar to that is I recently read a story about urging parents to let their kids get out and play in the dirt kind of thing.
Yeah, no, seriously. Yeah.
Because that helps build up an immune system.
It does. Yeah. It does. And so that was what I was alluding to. So that is something that is, I think, fairly conclusively shown now. I mean, everyone, there's always one study that comes along and says, well, you know, we're not completely sure on this, but you have to build up the immune systems of your kids. So your kids are going to have to get sick at some point to help them do that. And over time, they'll just develop these resistances. I mean, one of the ironic things is some parents will always say, well, yeah, they come home from school and they make me sick as well. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's just the way it goes.
That's the way it goes.
Viruses are changing. Bacteria are changing as well. So our immune systems constantly have to be updated.
No question. Donald just emailed us a question in regards to the Big Bang Theory. He says, quote, we are told the Big Bang happened 13 billion years ago, yet the solar system is only 5 billion years old. He says, we measure time on Earth today by the Earth's orbit around the sun once every 365 and a quarter days, being 1 year. How do you measure the time between the Big Bang and the creation of the solar system in years when the year as we know it did not exist, writes Don.
Oh, well, okay, so that's an interesting point. I mean, sure, but the concept of a certain amount of time exists no matter when the universe or whatever age the universe is. So you're right to suggest that we actually do use the year as a metric or a unit of time for us, and it's a very sort of human-centric concept. It's very sort of literally defined by our own solar system. So, but we use that primarily out of convenience, right? It's just a number. It's just a certain period of time. We actually do relate the overall time, sort of like the measurement of time in seconds, or the length of a second is set according to the number of vibrations of a certain atom. I can't remember which one it is. But that is very specifically defined by nature, right? That's not us. That's us choosing something that works roughly for us based upon a number of oscillations. So that concept of time and measurement of a unit of time does exist, even though the solar system didn't exist at the point. It's just sort of like an overall sort of like elapse of a given period of time. And that thing happens to exist whether or not the solar system was there.
Okay. 10:26, and Bob's given us a call with a question here this morning. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen. A beautiful day.
Yes, it is, Bob.
And, Doctor, congratulations. You certainly deserve it.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate that.
Yeah. I need help, Doctor.
Okay.
I need help. I kind of, it wasn't meant as an insult, but I'm bugging a friend of mine who, he doesn't understand science, or he's ignorant of science, he says, and I called him a fungi. And he kind of got upset, and I said, well, you could be a mushroom, too, because that's where life began. And I watched a program, and I read it before, that actually our planet, or life on our planet, started by a fungi.
Okay.
And do you understand?
I think I know what you're referring to. You're referring to something called panspermia.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. So this is an idea that goes back to British astrophysicist and a number of researchers back in the 1950s. And this is the idea that actually there may be ways of carrying genetic material throughout the galaxy on comets and things like that. And then they get deposited onto planets and then things evolve. It's an interesting thesis. I don't think the mainstream really does subscribe to it. There's a lot of evidence that the building blocks of DNA, amino acids and so on, those things are naturally formed in outer space anyway by basically having all of the right chemicals there and having a little bit of sunlight to make the chemical reactions happen. So most people in mainstream astrobiology don't take this particularly seriously, but some people certainly have written papers on it, and it's an idea that's worth thinking about. Where I think it's really interesting is the possibility that perhaps maybe life started on Mars earlier and there was an injection of maybe some bacteria from Mars and then they came to Earth. That could potentially have happened. It's a possibility. Whether it did happen or not is another thing altogether. So I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't take it that seriously personally.
But wouldn't it...
Bob, I'm going to put you on hold here because I have to take a break for a news update, all right?
Okay.
So you hang on and we'll get to you right after the news. And if you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Rob here this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker after a news update, and that's coming up next. Coming up now to 10:34 here on a Monday morning, Dr. Rob Thacker is with us. He's from St. Mary's University. He's an astrophysicist, and this is Science Files. And if you've got a comment or a question for us this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Bob, thanks for hanging on. You have a second part of your question for Rob here this morning.
Okay. That was a good answer, Doctor. And when the Big Bang started, if this fungi went all over the universe, then there's a possibility for life. But what they're finding out now that really interested me was the medical end of it, is that this fungi from mushrooms and that could be a break open in medicine that we've never imagined. So I'll leave it with you. And thank you very much.
Okay.
And congratulations.
Sure.
Again.
Thanks again, Bob. So one thing I will say is my understanding of panspermia is not necessarily... So why I think the fungi thing has come into this is because they talk about it as spores, like spores traveling across the interplanetary distances and so on. And I don't really think it was first necessarily envisaged as actually being a fungus itself. I think it was really primarily envisaged as being carrying materials that you need to create life, be that amino acids and so on. So I'm not entirely convinced that, again, although the word spore was used, I don't really think that they meant that to be a fungus in and of itself, because there are things that are simpler than fungi that have to exist as well. So they wouldn't necessarily have evolved. Everything couldn't really have evolved from fungi. But in terms of like potential benefits from various different fungi, different types of medicines and so on, yes, I'm sure there are many different things that we've been able to discover from fungi, incredibly diverse part of the ecosystem as well. So many different types, lots of them quite tasty as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, mushrooms.
Mushrooms, I love mushrooms.
Mushrooms, yeah.
Yep.
Portobello mushrooms, yum, 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 yum.
Yep, nothing like a good feed of steak covered in mushrooms.
I actually like doing a portobello mushroom like a steak.
Oh, really?
On the barbecue. Yeah, that's really good. And you can actually turn them upside down, and then you can actually put a sauce inside them, and they sort of like hold the sauce and cook the sauce.
Yeah, yeah. I'll have to try that.
Yeah.
Cassandra's giving us a call here this morning. Hi, Cassandra.
I just have a question for Dr. Rob. Now, you know, I didn't have enough time to research my question before you actually got to me. I thought I'd have a little more time. But I've been watching some documentaries on quantum physics, and then it got in a little bit into how our consciousness is actually a hallucination of our minds, and that mm-hmm. moment by moment we are creating our reality through our perception.
And your question is?
Is that... Is that a viable theory? Is that true?
So that is, in my opinion, one of the hardest things to explore in science, because I don't mind admitting, I literally lie awake at night wondering, how am I conscious?
Really?
I really do. And
me
I don't.
Too.
Yeah, I don't understand it, and I don't think science understands it, because all we can really do with science in this particular case is say, what are the things in our brain that correlate with things that we associate with consciousness? And so we have a number of things that correlate, like certain centers of the brain are active when you're conscious and certain other centers are active when you're unconscious. And so we can do that. But this idea that it's quantum mechanics, it's this thing somehow creating this, for want of a better term, movie screen on which we see the universe play around us and creates consciousness, I really struggle with that. And I don't honestly think that science has a good mechanism for explaining what consciousness actually is. I can give you an analogy. So if I sort of take an electric charge and I say, this is what electric charge does, and can give you all of these equations, and then at the end of the day, you can say, but what is it? I can't actually answer that, right? I can tell you what electric charge does as a scientist. I can give you beautiful formulae. I can predict what things with electric charge will do. But at the end of the day, that is something that is just what it is, and I can't tell you why that particular thing has charge. It's just a property of the universe as we know. I mean, we could go down to sort of like deeper theories, perhaps, but underlying the deeper theory, there's another theory and so on. So it's kind of like your Tower of Babel thing almost. So in terms of understanding what consciousness is and saying, is it this thing that happens because of quantum mechanics? I honestly don't accept that as a particularly strong scientific explanation. I mean, I know Roger Penrose, a very famous mathematician at Oxford, has written extensively about this, but I'm far from convinced. But I wouldn't say I'm an expert, so you shouldn't trust my opinion completely on this, and keep on reading. That's a great way to learn more about it.
Any follow-up?
Yeah, well, it was nice to actually ask a scientist, you know, rather than speculating and looking on forums and Reddit and so forth. I'm glad I had the opportunity to ask you what you thought.
No, it is a tremendous, it's one of the things that really does sort of bug me, because I don't see within the scientific framework a good way of explaining what consciousness is. People want to know what it is. What is this thing? And I totally understand that, because when we talk about science, we talk about atoms and so on. They're just things. They do things. And that's sort of like what the scientific method does. It allows you to predict stuff, but it doesn't always tell you why things are what they are. That's something that can be explained sometimes. So I'm not sort of like holding out no hope for consciousness ever being explained by science, but I think it's going to be a long time, an answer that's going to be a long time coming.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much.
Appreciate the call, Cassandra. Thanks. I'm not sure that I fully understand what you're saying here. Are you suggesting that we're walking around in a dream?
No, it's just suggesting that at the end of the day, right, there are all of these reactions that are driven by physics and that are going on. And so this concept that we have of free will to a certain extent is basically a mirage of all of these things that are happening, right? Now, to you and I, you're like, no, I make my decisions, right? And then we kind of feel that. But there is a suggestion that, in fact, all of these things are sort of like playing out, and we're literally, I mean, even I have a problem with this, because people say, well, it's like consciousness is sort of like this projection of what's going on. And so I'm like, well, who's watching the projection then? Right. So it doesn't make sense to me from that perspective. So it's very tricky and very difficult. Some people call it an epiphenomenon, a phenomenon built upon other things that we perhaps can't explain. And I've read a fair amount on this, and I've never read anything I find particularly convincing, to be honest.
Some people think, and it's a small minority, think that we're the play toys of some superior beings out there who are,
well,
you know,
I know, and so some not silly people have suggested this and even written papers on it. So my feeling about that is it's an interesting concept, but I'm not sure how you really explore it in any sensible way. And so it's kind of for me, as I'm being a very pragmatic person, I kind of say, well, so what? Right. We still sort of live in our own universe, and we have our own laws of physics to figure out and so on. And so I don't find that particularly useful or particularly exciting, quite frankly.
Until they decide that they no longer want to play with us.
Well, I'm more worried about other things happening than that.
Well, let's talk about some isolated lakes found beneath the Canadian ice sheet. This is underneath the Devon Ice Cap, which is up in the Canadian Arctic. Two subglacial bodies of water have been spotted beneath over 500 meters of ice. This water has an estimated maximum temperature of -10.5, so it apparently need to be very salty to avoid freezing. What's the significance of this now, Dr. Rob?
So the real significance of this, and you're going to love it, Rick,
yep,
is that we're interested in these kind of ecosystems because of the life that they have in them. Right. And so why is that interesting? Because of icy moons. We know that around giant planets,
Jupiter, for example,
Jupiter and Saturn, there are these moons that are basically giant ice balls surrounding a sort of center which is letting out a little bit of geothermal heat. And so there should be, in many of these systems, actually subsurface oceans under very extreme pressures, probably still very cold, but the question is,
what's living in them?
Could there be life in there, right? And so understanding what these kind of environments are like on the Earth is really a big step forward in actually going out and being able to understand what those systems might be like. They could, of course, be completely different. And you could say, well, you know, at one point in time, these systems probably weren't under a huge ice cap. And were there bacteria existing at that time, and have they been sealed off and so on? And the answer to that is, well, yes, that's probably true. But understanding how life evolves within these systems is still interesting from that perspective.
But they haven't found any life in these glacial lakes yet.
What's interesting about these ones is no one expected to find these lakes in the Canadian Arctic, because this is in an ice cap that was considered to be essentially frozen down to several hundreds of meters. I think it's like almost a kilometer in some places.
Yep.
And they didn't expect to find these subglacial lakes. They found them in Antarctica. There's one famous one called Lake Vostok, which has actually been drilled into. But finding these in the Canadian Arctic is interesting because it's a much, much easier to work in the Canadian Arctic than it is to work in Antarctica. Right, you can actually fly in there in the winter, whereas you can't do that in Antarctica, obviously. And so this would be a potentially really interesting place to go and carefully, I should say this is really important, carefully drill down and then sample and then see what these particular environments are like.
Why do you stress carefully?
Because it's very easy to pollute these environments. These are pristine environments which we want to take care of as best we can. They have essentially been locked off probably, I think people are estimating about 120,000 years.
Wow.
Right? So in this particular case, any kind of foreign bodies coming into this system is going to change that ecosystem. So we have to be careful about how we do this. In fact, Lake Vostok, the whole process of drilling down to that took several years, and it's really challenging to drill into ice because what tends to happen is that it just refreezes around the drill bit. So you have to keep it open somehow, and one of the ways that the Russian drill team did that was to, believe it or not, pour gasoline down it.
Oh, no, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, no. And so that was a real problem, and so they had to try and get as much of it out as they could at the end and so on, but still some of that probably went into Lake Vostok. We'd have to find a better way of doing it if we were going to do that with these particular lakes. And so we just have to be careful when we do this, but nonetheless, absolutely fascinating things to study.
Did they find anything in Lake Vostok at all?
I'm not sure what the analysis of Lake Vostok has shown. I should actually go and look that up. I really don't know.
But are we expecting fish, or are we talking, you know, microbacteria?
I think most people are focused on microbes. These things are probably going to be pretty dark, pretty cold. The water's under a lot of pressure, right? If there were fish in there, I don't know what they would be eating. There's very little light down there, which is not to say that we don't have fish down in the very deepest parts of the ocean that don't have light. We do. But I think most people are focused on microbial life.
And again, the expectation is that there would be similar life on some of these moons around Jupiter or Saturn.
As we can, what are we likely to find when we go to other planets? And the answer is microbes.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like we're going to sort of come along and meet the alien version of Rick Howe. Probably got a better show. No, just kidding.
Write that down here somewhere. Just make a note of that.
So when we go out and we look, and in fact, when we look at the atmospheres of planets around other stars, we're really looking for signatures that largely be signatures that come from microbes.
Very interesting. David just emailed to say, "Hi, Rob, how are you? Fine. How do you know? Consciousness is a projection that you, we, somebody watches. We are the dreamers and the dream," he writes.
Okay.
just saying.
Yeah.
10:47, Dr. Rob with us here on Science Files, and we'll be back with more right after this quick break. Coming up now to 10:50 here on a Monday morning, and Rick is on the line with a question here this morning. Hi, Rick.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen.
How you doing this morning?
Good. A few weeks ago, last time you were on, Dr. Rob, I asked regarding the shift of the Earth's magnetic poles and whether or not we would be in danger if, in fact, it actually happened, you know, while we still occupied the planet. I don't know when that would happen, but apparently the poles are on the move now. The South Pole is now not actually on the continent of Antarctica from a couple of things I saw. So just wondering if you'd found out anything else about that.
All right. Any more on the...
I'm going to be honest to say, no, Rick, I haven't heard that it's shifting noticeably. I mean, there are always sort of like small changes, but I hadn't heard that it had shifted noticeably. Where did you read that?
Might have been, I heard it on Quirks and Quirks. That's the reason I called the last time, is that Bob McDonald interviewed this University of Toronto scientist who had been working up north.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't actually her field, but kind of led her into this. So that's where I got the information. She was talking about that. The actual podcast is still on CBC, and it was from January.
Okay.
All right.
So anyway, I'll just throw that out. That's one question I have is, when it does shift, are, you know, we going to suffer because of the magnetic shoot changing its shape?
Appreciate the call, Rick. Thanks.
So the honest answer is yes, there will be a period of time as it shifts when we will have an increased amount of radiation coming through.
What's that?
Sorry?
Oh.
That's me.
One and suddenly the orchestra popped up. And I said, orchestra? Okay. Where's our orchestra?
Yeah. Bit of a light relief there. So yes, the honest answer is because of the important role that the Earth's magnetic field plays in actually pushing all of the really sort of like high energy particles that are coming in, primarily from the sun actually, to the poles and sort of like keeping them away from the surface of the Earth, that is really beneficial to us and really important. So as everything switched, then presumably those pole positions are actually going to move around. So the key thing will be what happens to the overall strength of the field as it flips. So if it goes through to zero and then ramps back up again, as it goes down, there will be a small period of time. I don't know how long that would be. I'm not an expert. You'll have to talk to a geophysicist, where we would lack a little bit of protection. But that's not going to be in... Well, the fact that we still have life on the Earth and we've had multiple pole shifts suggests to me that that is not something that's devastating for the overall ecosystem.
So we're all not going to die.
We would also be able to make sure that we can go into our houses and get protection and things like that as well. I mean, this is not the kind of radiation that you can't shield yourself from. It's not like gamma radiation or something like that. So, yeah, we can actually protect ourselves to a certain extent.
Good to hear. 10:53 is the time. SpaceX now wants to provide high-speed internet service to everyone, that is, everyone in the whole world. And they've got a big plan, Dr. Rob. They're going to send thousands of satellites up into space. And how feasible is this? And let's hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, no, I actually think this is really interesting from a Nova Scotia and rural Nova Scotia perspective as well. So many people are probably aware that many people in rural communities don't still have good access to high-speed internet. This is a real problem, and especially if we want to connect people and make them part of the wider community. And so... one of the things you can do, obviously, is invest and build fiber optic infrastructure. But that is really quite expensive to do. You have very long lines to run in some cases, and governments are reticent to do this. Whether that's appropriate or not is a political question, right? They are reticent to do it because of the cost. So the idea of having satellites up there is that you can have a system that covers essentially the whole of the planet with internet coverage at, believe it or not, a gigabit per second, which is considerably more than most people will sell you even over fiber optic right now.
Hmm.
And so this is something that both SpaceX, Elon Musk yet again, and Jeff Bezos behind Blue Origin are both very, very interested in. So there is actually a little bit of competition going on. SpaceX has something called Starlink, which just got FCC approval. And OneWeb has had FCC approval for some time as well. So OneWeb is backed by Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos. So they have to build literally a new rocket that will actually launch these satellites. And then SpaceX already has its Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy ready to do this. And so there's a bit of a competition going on, right? You're looking at huge networks of satellites. Like now there's about 1,700 satellites up there. The craziest sort of like... detailed plan for Starlink that I've seen involves 12,000 satellites, which would be completely different from what we have up there right now.
Really?
In practice, I think it's going to be a lot smaller than that. Certainly, OneWeb is talking between 800 and 1,500 satellites. The more satellites you have, the more bandwidth, the more data you can move. So this would be really, really useful and really helpful for people living in rural areas. It would also solve the issue of building out fibre optic cables, although ultimately the beautiful thing about fibre optic cables is you can always increase the overall data rates on those. You just need newer and newer switching technologies.
And they're hoping, SpaceX that is, hopes to have these satellites in orbit by the mid-2020s. Meantime, as you mentioned, people in rural Nova Scotia...
Yeah.
You know, some of them are still dealing with, with dial-up.
Yeah. So the problem there is even if you build out sort of like fiber optic lines, that's going to take time as well.
Yeah.
And so they're building things out. You're looking at probably a 2 or 3 years to build it as well. So the question is, if you've got this race going on, which is the better one? I think to a certain extent, fiber optics will always give you more options down the road, but it just is that much more expensive, right, for the governments to actually provide. So I think a lot of them tend to shy away from that and sort of like look at where the tax dollars are going. So I think satellite internet will be a really big thing. I mean, I should say, I've talked about Nova Scotia. Obviously, there are huge rural populations in the US as well. So
yeah.
There's strong, strong interest in the US as well. And a number of state governments in the US are talking about this and trying to decide which is better. And so many of them are actually falling down on the side of going towards the satellite internet. I mean, it's a little bit problematic in as much that then you are literally in Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos's hands for when this gets done, right? And that's not good. You don't want to sort of like be waiting for these people to do it. And so I'm surprised to see SpaceX now saying mid-2020s. I'd heard they wanted to get things going within 2 years. But it will take them time to get all of these satellites up. You just have to do the math. 4,000 satellites takes a lot of launches.
Yeah, and that'll make things... pretty much clutter up the space around the Earth,
yeah,
not?
Yeah. So economists are sort of looking at this and going, this is interesting. Are they going to really make money from it? Bearing in mind that the last sort of like, or the few big satellite phone systems we've put up there have by and large failed quite badly, right? So people are saying, who needs internet everywhere? I think I'm quietly hopeful that this actually will turn out to be relatively successful, but I don't envisage 12,000 satellites.
Seriously.
I really don't think that will happen. I think there'll probably be like 1,500. The question will be how it gets paid for, right? And that is a question that I think the economists really are interested in the details. Who's going to be prepared to pay the money to have this service? I would.
I'm sure.
I'd love to be able to go and use the internet wherever I am on the planet.
That would be a really
cool thing.
That would be indeed. Yeah. Dr. Rob, as always, another interesting hour. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Rick. Always a pleasure to come on.
And you have a great week, and we'll talk to you again. 10:58 is our time right now. Dr. Rob and Science Files brought to you by Meadow Ridge Estates, Bungalow Lifestyle Living right here in Halifax. We're going to take a break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off. We've got an open hour coming up after the news. We call it Manic Monday, and anything goes. Give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, and we'll take your calls after a news update, and that is coming up next.